Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Well, it's four mornings after the Democratic Convention, and we're getting our first read now on the Democratic Convention bounce. A survey taken Friday and Saturday by the Morning Consult poll, finds that Clinton got a pretty strong 7-point bounce from the convention. According to a polling analysis on 538, Donald Trump had gotten a 3 to 4 points bounce. So according to Morning Consult, Clinton went from trailing by 4 points nationally after the Republican convention to leading by 3 points by over this past weekend. Now, the experts say take both polling bounces as temporary, which historically makes sense. So don't take these for more than they're worth. But what they probably are worth is simply an indication that neither convention failed from an infomercial standpoint, and neither convention did terrible damage to the opposing candidate, at least on the first impressions that people had who actually took in some convention content, despite all the bashing of the other candidate at each convention. A couple of other interesting numbers from Morning Consult, just some markers of where the general election campaign begins. Remember how Bernie Sanders did so well with millennials and Clinton not at all? Well, she is by far the millennial candidate as of right now. Trump is only polling 25% among young adults, but Clinton is only polling 33% among people over 65. So it's the exact opposite for her on both ends of the age spectrum than it was in the primaries. And the undecided vote is pretty big, according to this Morning Consult poll, 17%. Clinton leads Trump in the poll 43 to 40. That makes 83% total. And they list 17% as undecided in a head-to-head matchup. They also ran it another way, though, including Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson. In that scenario, he gets 11%, which is a lot for a third-party candidate. And it comes mostly from Trump. In that scenario, Clinton's lead over Trump jumps to 5 points, and undecideds are 12%, still substantial. It does not look to me like they ran a model including Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, so Morning Consult gets an incomplete in that respect. And all of this will change. There are almost 100 days before the election. Gary Johnson will get better known, which could help him or hurt him. Jill Stein, too, presumably, unless there's a media blackout. And we don't talk about polls very much on this show like I'm doing now, and we'll continue not to, rather than focus more on issues and character as we do. But this is one of those mornings where I just thought it's interesting to take note of a new poll as kind of a baseline marker for the start of the general election season and the end of the conventions. And I should say this is just about top-line voter preference numbers, too. It doesn't look at the electoral vote map, which is, of course, what really determines who wins. And just very briefly on that, Clinton is doing a little better when you crunch it swing state by swing state. Trump would have to win all three of Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, or lose Florida but do better than Republicans usually do in the Midwest Rust Belt states. And even that assumes Clinton doesn't win any typically red states, which could happen because Trump is so controversial. Maybe in Georgia, say the numbers, maybe in Arizona, maybe in Utah, Mormon Tatum. So there you go. It's a tough map for Trump, but not impossible. Now, if the convention spectacles change a few minds for a little while and that's all, what about the post-convention jockeying? Well, the first real storyline to break out of the convention bubble, as most of you know, was Donald Trump being Donald Trump, this time with respect to the Democratic Convention speaker, the father of Humayun Khan, a Muslim-American U.S. Army soldier who died an American hero in battle in Iraq. The father, Kaiser Khan, shook a copy of the Constitution, as you no doubt know by now, at the convention on Thursday.
Have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy. You have sacrificed nothing and no one.
Kaiser Khan to Trump with his wife, Ghazala, standing by his side. And that little fact was what Trump decided to go after in a response on ABC this week.
I saw him. He was, very emotional and probably looked like a nice guy to me. His wife, if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say, you tell me, but plenty of people have written that. She was extremely quiet, and it looked like she had nothing to say. A lot of people have said that.
Trump on ABC this week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday. So now the usual cycle has begun once again, like after Trump insulted POWs or disabled people or Seventh-day Adventists or pretended not to know who David Duke was, or take your pick. David Brooks called Trump a moral pygmy on Meet the Press yesterday. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and John McCain all issue statements disagreeing with the comments, denouncing the comments, and call them antithetical to American values, but continue to support Trump anyway as better equipped to manage the nuclear codes than Hillary Clinton, they say. And maybe like with his previous slights of non-whites and non-males, this will actually help Trump in the polls. That remains to be seen. By the way, Mrs. Khan, Ghazala Khan, did speak on MSNBC on Friday, like about things she said to her son.
I was really worried, and I talked to him about all this, that this is a war, and I don't want you to go out or do something stupid, and don't be a hero. Please come back and go safely. My prayers are with you, and be strong. So he told me, Mom, I have a responsibility that I cannot deny. I have to be taking care of my soldiers because they depend on me. But still I was keep telling him, be safe and don't become hero for me. Just be my son. Come back as a son. He came back as a hero.
Ghazala Khan on MSNBC on Friday. Her son did take care of the other soldiers. He was a captain in the army, and they say he died sacrificing his body for them. Now, if you'll indulge me, I think it's worth a minute to lay out the depth of the smear on the Khan family. It's being played mostly as an insult to a mother of a patriotic son who died in combat in the army, and that's bad enough. But it's really broader than that, if you think about it. Trump said if Mrs. Khan didn't say anything, maybe it was because she's not allowed to say anything. Let's call this implication what it is. It's that this family, whose son died fighting for our country, might actually be adherents to strict Sharia law, which might not allow a woman to speak publicly. Which means, one, they might be traitors, sympathetic to terrorists who want to impose that kind of society on America, because that might be who they are in their hearts, since she wasn't allowed to speak. Therefore, no Muslim can be trusted, even though those whose sons die fighting in the U.S. Army and who hold up the U.S. Constitution, not the Quran, on TV. And two, if even this Gold Star family is incompatible with the American value of gender equality, we better not let any more Muslims in. And we better be suspicious of all the ones who are already around us. That's what Trump implies by asking, why didn't she say anything? And of course, it appeals to the worst impulses that some Americans have. And we'll see if this costs Trump in the polls or if he actually benefits from it, which has been the pattern with things like this so far. Joining me now to talk about the start of the general election season, Politico correspondents Annie Carney, who covers the Clinton campaign, and Ben Schreckinger, who covers the Trump campaign. Hi, Annie. Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, Brian.
Thanks for having us.
And listeners, our phones are open for anything on the presidential race. 212-433-WNYC, 433 9692. And Annie will get to your really great story on Politico, taking us behind the scenes about how Clinton and Sanders worked together to minimize the Sanders delegate insurgency last week. A lot of details in there that I think people don't know. But is the Clinton campaign trying to capitalize on the Trump-Con incident explicitly, or are they just leaving the outrage to others who are putting out statements this morning?
She talked about it yesterday. She was on a three-day bus tour through Western Pennsylvania and Ohio, and she didn't talk about it from any of the stages she took, but she talked about it in a little – she took a few questions from reporters, and we asked her, and she answered. But they're not making a huge deal out of it. I think they want to keep it as a fight between Trump and Khan, not a fight between Trump and Clinton. But they are also, I think they put out a statement or Twitter today saying thanks but no thanks to the John McCains and to the Paul Ryans and to whoever else is admonishing his words but continuing to support him, saying, like, if you're not going to say you're not supporting Trump, then, well, good are your words castigating this latest insult round. But in general, I think that they're being careful not to get in Trump's way as he goes into day five of this totally insane post-convention story.
And Ben, how about the Trump campaign? I saw Paul Manafort, his campaign manager, on TV yesterday saying, no, media, you're getting the story all wrong. You shouldn't be talking about this. Look over here. The problem is radical Islam and the threat from Islamists sneaking into our country. Like, you're getting the story all wrong. He said that.
Yeah, and the challenge for Paul Manafort and other seasoned representatives of this campaign is keeping the campaign on message in that way. The problem is that the candidate often can't resist the ad hominem attack, can't resist keeping controversies that hurt him in the news by lashing out. And so Trump has already commented this morning on Twitter as he sits watching Mr. Khan do more interviews on television, and he has two more events today in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and you better believe that the campaign is wondering what he's going to say about this today.
Is there any indication? I guess it's just too early to know if this is going to help or hurt him in the polls. But there is this long history, which can make one fret about the state of a lot of the American people, of when he calls Mexicans rapists or says there has to be a complete ban on Muslims coming into the country even to visit their families, that he goes up in the polls, at least in the context of the Republican primaries. So do we know that this is really going to hurt him as opposed to help him, Ben?
You know, we won't know until we see polling come out probably next week that reflects this period. That being said, you're absolutely right. Trump was rewarded for making outrageous statements in ways that really shocked political observers throughout the primary. But if you look at what's happened since he's clinched the nomination in May, and it's been more of a question of general election polling, his comments about Judge Curiel in the Trump University case attacking him for his Mexican heritage, his response to the Orlando massacre at that nightclub, in which he tweeted that he appreciated the congrats for being right about Islamic terrorism. Both of those pretty clearly hurt him in the polls. And so it's very possible that the dynamic has changed and that, as you would expect, these outrageous statements now are going to hurt him with the general election electorate.
Let's take a phone call. People are calling in on this, and then we'll go to some other things, including this new sort of patriotism, or is it faux patriotism, that the Democrats are displaying at their convention and since. Dennis in Newton, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for allowing me to come on. From the historical sense of what's going on, when I listened in particular this morning to the Scarborough program and listened to the family as they talked about what they were going through, I'm hoping that what we get from this is sort of like a period during the McCarthy era, when a lawyer sat across from him after a series of interviews, series of investigations, and he asked them one simple thing: have you no shame? That particular statement brought Joe McCarthy to his knees and ended his rule. The press began to respond the way they should have, truly going after the man. Our media has really failed us. I'm not speaking of you, but in general, the man has been made to be a great so-called spokesperson for a lot of people. And it's only because of that he talks and he's not questioned, he's not challenged. Mr. Khan and his wife challenged him about his lack of empathy, his morals, the whole thing. This is a family that represents all of America. Most of America has somebody who's been in the military. Many people have lost children, husbands, wives. It cuts across all political, all ethnic, all religious lines.
Dennis, I'm gonna leave it there, and I really appreciate it. Annie Carney from Politico. I guess one question I have about Dennis's comment, and I've heard some other people say this, is this that moment, like in the Joe McCarthy era, have you no shame? I don't know if this is the moment. I don't know who has the standing of the person who said that line back then with people who are Trump supporters or with people who are undecided. I'm not sure it's Kaiser Khan. I'm not sure even a Gold Star father who's a Muslim and has an accent, politically speaking, can have that standing. If John McCain has denounced him, if half the Republicans in the Congress didn't attend the Republican convention, I don't know who has that standing to be that one voice.
It's a really good question. I don't know who it is. I mean, is it John McCain? Is it these Republican leaders who are denouncing him but still supporting him if they did pull their endorsements?
But Ben, since you cover the Trump campaign, is there anybody they're actually afraid of not endorsing them, or any Republican who might stand up and say, I can't take this anymore, I'm withholding my endorsement? Now, that's what Kaiser Khan, when he went on some follow-up interviews over the weekend, implored Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to do. So far, at least, they're not doing it. They're saying they denounced the statement. They still think he'd be a better president than Hillary Clinton. Is there anybody who Trump is actually afraid of?
Arguably Vladimir Putin, obviously, for different reasons. The way that they handle...
Wait, you mean saying things that are too nice about him?
No. Just he seems to respect Putin as a ruthless operator.
Right. I guess I just mean, is there any American Republican who could stand up? I mean, obviously, if Paul Ryan, not even obviously, but maybe, if Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell did say, this is it, now he's gone too far, I can't even support him anymore, I'm doing what Mitt Romney says he'll do, that doesn't seem to matter to many people, which is vote for neither Trump nor Clinton. Maybe if Paul Ryan said that, it would be that have you no shame moment. But I don't even know that. But I don't know, you don't get any indication that there's no American Republican who Trump is actually afraid of, who the campaign is actually afraid of, saying, we just can't take this anymore.
Yeah, with Paul Ryan, in the period before Ryan offered his endorsement, the Trump campaign did treat that relationship very delicately. There were some signs of deference. My suspicion, though, is that if Ryan were to withhold his endorsement or condemn Trump in stronger terms, that it would be more or less the same as what's happened with Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney. These people who you think have this national stature, you may find out don't have that stature with the voters that Trump attracts.
It's also, if you look at his convention, like Hillary Clinton's convention had huge stars of the party making the case for her. Trump really had his family members up there. He wasn't depending so much on outside people to make the case for him, maybe because he couldn't get them in the first place, or maybe because he doesn't need them. But it means that there's not as many people he's depending on for support. I mean, if Ivanka Trump turned on him, maybe that would be something.
I guess so. Actually, did you see the new Melania plagiarism? Or I guess not plagiarism. It's fabrication story. I guess after the Melania plagiarism kerfuffle, whoever actually put that in a speech, she's now taken down her website because it was pointed out that she lied about having a college degree. She started college in Slovenia, according to the report I read, but left sophomore year to become a model in Milan. But the website said she graduated college, and now the website is gone. Did you see that?
Ben? I didn't see that, but...
Go ahead. Ben. No. Either of you. Annie, go ahead.
I didn't see that, but the Chiron for her said that she, during her speech, said she had some sort of design degree, which our reporters, Ben and Julia Yossi, have reported she never completed. So the Chiron also was wrong when she was giving her speech.
Huh. Yeah, that's the same. Yeah. That's the same story. Ben, have they responded to that in any way?
No, they haven't. And often when they're caught on something like that, a campaign and a candidate who often can't resist responding to press queries really does shut down. So I don't suspect we're going to hear an explanation or anything of that sort about this degree that was made up. What I'm wondering is whether there are immigration implications, whether she, when she got her visa to come to the United States, she said she had a college degree because for some visas, that's a requirement, or at least helps you.
What was the line that was stolen from Michelle Obama? My word is my bond. Karen in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Morning, Brian. What I was actually going to say, I just want to make one point first, that Melania came in on an H-1B visa for models, not the H-1B visa that requires a college degree.
We have H-1B visas for models in particular?
Correct.
Right? Meaning, which would assume, because the nature of the H-1B visa is for people with skills that we can't find Americans who possess. Am I wrong?
Correct.
So presumably there weren't enough. What's the word? I don't know if the word is beautiful or the word is kind of having models build or whatever the qualifications are for a model. There weren't enough Americans to do that.
Well, there's a special category for models within the H-1B visa category, and they don't need a college degree, unlike the professional specialty occupation H-1B people. But I would just point out that Donald Trump has said he wants to cancel the H-1B visa category entirely.
Yes.
But the purpose of my call was this.
Which is a legitimate conversation, by the way, whether that's being abused rather, by companies who use it to bring in cheaper labor, skilled labor from other countries. And there are American engineers and other Americans who could be getting jobs or getting jobs at better wages who can't because of the H-1B. So I think that's a real conversation to have. Anyway, Karen, go ahead.
Well, I would just say this. I'm an immigration lawyer, and before you can bring someone in on an H-1B visa, you have to sign under penalty of perjury that you will pay them the prevailing wage that is determined by the Department of Labor for the occupation in your actual location. So there's much has been made of that, but that's a discussion for another day.
Do you think that's enforced? Since you're an immigration lawyer, do you think that has real meaning once the people get here?
It does to some extent. There are some corporations that are deterred and want to do the right thing. I have no doubt that it is also exploited in places and is not adhered to, and it is the responsibility of the Department of Labor and USCIS to be sending around inspectors, which they do from time to time. The penalties are very heavy for noncompliance. But let's not forget, we're talking about 65,000 visas a year. People make such a big deal about this H-1B visa. We're talking about 65,000 visas.
Very small
it's
number.
It's not a lot. Very small number of people in the U.S. workforce.
All right. I know that's not the point that you originally called to make, so go ahead.
The point I originally called to make was this. My concern, and it may be premature since the election has not yet happened, is as follows. That the genie is out of the bottle that even if Trump would lose the election, that the level of political discourse and what may and may not be said, that the floor has been forever lowered, and that even if he were to lose the election, the rules of the game may have changed forever, both in terms of how we view candidates, how we allow our potential elected representatives to speak publicly, and also with respect to the Republican Party. Because I think what you were saying earlier about the Trump campaign being immune to all of these heretofore, we thought, impressive Republican figures who had the respect of their supporters. The fact that that is no longer true shows us, I think, that there is this huge swath of the electorate that has really been alienated, that has not felt represented either by the Democrats or the Republicans. And perhaps they sat in the Republican camp prior to this election because it was where they felt most comfortable. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering what this might do afterwards. If the rules have so forever changed, who are these people going to be represented by, even if Trump loses the election? Are they suddenly going to go back to voting for, I don't know, John Kasich or Paul Ryan or Cruz? It seems to me like we've reached a tipping point and that something, we may look back upon this as a watershed moment for American democracy. And it's kind of scary to me. And I wonder what your guests think about that.
Karen, thank you. And my guests are Ben Schrechinger, who covers the Trump campaign for Politico, and Annie Carney, who covers the Clinton campaign for Politico. Annie, it's obviously such a big question, but do you have any thoughts for Karen?
I mean, it's a huge question, and I've thought about this, too, and going back to Sarah Palin's emergence on the national stage, and I've wondered, was that something that was a crack, some sort of part of the ceiling that led to Trump, led like this idea that someone who doesn't know anything about world politics is suddenly on the national stage, and now we have Trump, and who are going to be the mini Trumps that come after this? I think that the rhetoric that we can expect from candidates, like we're in a different world now. But the question is how much, I mean, if he is rejected by the American people and Hillary Clinton, who is really disliked by a large part of the electorate, and she manages to beat him, is that just a repudiation of everything that he's done? I don't know. I think it's a little too soon to say, but it's definitely a concern of what comes after Trump, especially for the Republican Party, that will be entirely fractured by this.
It's way too soon to say. And Ben, it is interesting that Trump is campaigning in some areas like the Youngstown, Akron area in Ohio that have gone Democratic in recent presidential elections, and with a particular pretty large group of mostly white working class, not college educated Americans who aren't just racist, but maybe susceptible to, you know, the white nationalist appeal, mostly because they think that they've been abandoned by the Democratic Party, and maybe they're too quick to blame immigrants for their problems, but they don't see their jobs coming back. They don't see Mitt Romney, didn't see Mitt Romney as somebody who was serious about bringing back jobs for people like them. They don't trust the Democratic Party to be bringing back jobs for people like them. And there is a desperation that attaches to something that sounds strong and sounds determined on their behalf. And we don't know. Assuming Trump loses, we don't know where that goes, how that shifts the political landscape. Like, let's say he loses, but he comes close. How does that shift what a President Clinton does in office? How does that shift how Democrats run in the future? Never mind what happens to the Republican Party, which is what you're covering, and whether they have to shift the ground under their feet.
It's a great question. I think that the susceptibility of this bloc to Trump's message really highlights a major failure of the Democratic Party to find a way to appeal to these people, to make them feel welcome in a party that traditionally has depended on them, and you know, economically really caters many of its policies to this group. Although, of course, there's huge opposition to free trade, which prior to this cycle, at least, had pretty resounding bipartisan support. What's interesting is someone like Jim Webb, who ran in the Democratic primary, really trying to appeal to these white working class voters, and found just absolutely no toehold in the Democratic Party. So is there some mixture of a Jim Webb, Bernie Sanders type who can lead these people back to the Democrats? Is there a Trump without the baggage who can bring this bloc more completely over to the Republican Party? It's going to be fascinating to watch no matter what happens.
There's another little Trump thing that just got brought to my attention over the weekend. There was just so much happening the last 2 weeks. I couldn't see every detail. But tell me, Ben, if this is true as far as you know. Did he get Clinton's running mate wrong? I see that it looks like days after the selection of Tim Kaine, Trump tweeted that he was a failed governor of New Jersey, confusing him with Tom Kaine, who was a Republican governor of New Jersey and widely considered very successful, by the way, but that's beside the point. Did he confuse Democrat Tim Kaine with Republican Tom Kaine days after the nomination was announced?
I don't know if he tweeted that. He absolutely did say it at a press conference.
Oh, he said it.
Before being corrected by a reporter. Trump, of course, had business dealings in Atlantic City in New Jersey before Tom Kaine, so that governor would be familiar to him. But obviously not a very flattering portrait to paint of yourself, mixing up your opponent's name.
On the Hillary Clinton, Tom Kaine, Tim Kaine bus tour this weekend, Kaine used that as his opening line. It's become part of his stump speech, like laughing at Trump for trying to come up with a nickname for him and calling him the worst failed governor from New Jersey. So he's saying it at every stop now.
Uh-huh. I didn't realize that had become such a thing. All right. We're just about out of time. Annie, I want you to get a chance, because you wrote such an interesting behind-the-scenes article on Politico, to tell us a little bit about how the Clinton and Sanders team worked together to quell the insurgency at the Democratic convention. Would the heart of it be the things that Sanders wanted in exchange and got for the level of cooperation that he gave?
Yeah, I think that's the heart of it. They sort of realized weeks in advance that they were going to have to cooperate more with the Sanders camp than they had originally thought, giving them shared access to the boiler room, which is kind of the nerve center where the winning campaign typically runs the entire convention in front of show. Sanders campaign operators wanted to be down there. They approached the DNC CEO weeks ago and said, we need access. What if there's a contested convention? And I think that sort of idea scared the Clinton people enough into thinking, you know what, let's just do this together. And they really worked together to control the delegates on the floor who were booing the first day. They had a joint whip operation on the floor with Sanders people explaining to angry Sanders supporters why they were supporting Clinton. And in return, what I found was most interesting was originally the Clinton campaign wanted Sanders to speak at 9 p.m., which is not prime time, on the first night, and then have Michelle Obama and Elizabeth Warren speak after him. Sanders was not happy with that. He felt it was his due to get a primetime speaking slot, and they gave it to him. And the Clinton campaign didn't want Ben Jealous, a former president of the NAACP and a big Sanders supporter, to speak. But Sanders told them it was important to show his supporters that their voices were being heard, so they gave it to him. One thing they would not give to him, he wanted to be introduced by former Ohio Representative Nina Turner, who was a huge critic of Clinton during the primary.
And was on cable TV constantly throughout the campaign season. One of the primary faces for Bernie Sanders for months and months and months.
Yes, and he wanted her to be the one to introduce him, and they put their foot down and said, absolutely not, she cannot speak. So she staged a little protest. She came into the media tent. You know, like, it's over when you have to go into the media tent to get attention. Instead of having their words come to you. But so they said no, but and Sanders said fine, and he was introduced by someone from Vermont, I forget who, and not no one of a no big name. And but in the end, so there was a lot of back and forth, and every day the two campaigns would meet and talk about the runner show. And I mean, from the outside it looked like a really successful 4 days. First day there was some boos, but by the time Obama got up there, it was pretty unified audience. The anti-TPP signs were drowned out with the USA signs, but it really took a lot of daily work between the Sanders and the Clinton campaigns, kind of negotiating on a day-to-day basis.
Were the TPP signs, and people who watched a lot of the convention on TV will have noticed that there were a lot of anti-TPP signs, the Pacific trade deal that Sanders people brought. Was that a surprise? And they had to scramble and print up all these USA signs so that there would be more of those for the TV audience to see?
No, I think that the USA's all, like, each speaker has signs associated with the speaker. I think that's planned way in advance. So, but the anti-TPP signs, I think they were expecting a group of the Burn or Bust crew to disrupt. So I don't think it was a surprise that there was anti-TPP protesters there. I think that's why they started working with the Sanders campaign weeks in advance, because they knew they were going to have a problem.
And I was going to bring up in this segment and take calls on, but we'll have to do it another day because we got so into the things we were talking about, that USA is not something you usually hear Democrats chanting a lot. You can almost predict that it's a Republican crowd when people chant USA, USA. But this was going on at the Democratic convention by design, I presume, in response to Trump saying America isn't great by implication.
Yeah, I think that he's really ceded to them the flag imagery and the USA chants that are seen by Democrats as jingoistic and unsophisticated, but they're embracing it and like re-embracing patriotism because they think Trump has you know, said so many terrible things about how terrible the country is. And I talked to some Republicans who think that's a huge mistake, that conservatism without optimism is just really dark and depressing.
We will leave it there on that point. And we'll come back to this and do a call-in maybe for Democrats who are seeing this and identifying with it, or maybe identifying with it some and feeling a little uncomfortable with it or whatever. But that's to be followed up on. We thank Annie Carney, who covers the Clinton campaign for Politico, and Ben Schreckinger, who covers the Trump campaign for Politico, for joining us on this first weekday after the conventions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, there was some behind-the-scenes intrigue at the Democratic convention, too, and it was within the New York delegation. And we'll talk to Ben Max from Gotham Gazette about that right after this.